This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Construction on a key section of the Dakota Access Pipeline has been halted for now. The U.S. Army Corps of Engineers denied a permit that would have allowed for construction just north of the Standing Rock Sioux Reservation. The proposed path of the pipeline brought protesters to North Dakota from around the country. We're going to talk to one woman who made the journey from Kalamazoo. Monica Washington Padula was part of the protest at Standing Rock in November. Thank you very much for being here.
Thank you for having me. Bonjour.
What made you decide that you wanted to go and be part of this protest?
Well, I think, like many of us, I was in a big state of disbelief viewing the videos on social media of the attacks on the water protectors, and really felt helpless. Like, there was nothing I could do. Yeah, we could send money. We could send messages of encouragement and support to those there. But it was one of those just deep-seated convictions that made me really wonder, well, is there more that I could do? And I really felt that it was something that I could put forth more effort towards, especially being an Indigenous woman. I definitely felt that responsibility to take up action when I heard the call for help.
Did you have any concerns yourself about personal safety when you went there?
Absolutely. For me personally, I purposefully took a couple of months to gauge the situation. Is it going to get better? Someone's going to step in. Somebody from the administration is going to step in. This isn't going to get far. Somebody's going to make sure that these protectors see justice from what they're experiencing and what we're watching them experience. But I had to face the reality that it really was not getting better. And so by the time I had my trip planned, which I planned it a month in advance, I was along the way hoping that things would get better and that I wouldn't have to take that trip. But once I saw that they were not and it was getting worse, then I knew that it really wasn't an option. The biggest fears was that in my communications with people who had both been there, who were currently keeping an eye on the situation, and basically what was floating around the media, I was mostly concerned about being stopped by the police. There were stories of people being stopped and having their items confiscated, having them desecrated, and that there was an overall attempt to prevent people from being able to take needed supplies to the camp, and our caravan was taking some supplies for donation. So that was my biggest concern, was facing that before I even made it into the camp. Luckily, we did go an alternate route where we were able to evade that, and we were able to get there safely with no problems. And so I think that we were pretty fortunate in that.
And let's remind people, when exactly did you go? What dates are we talking about?
I arrived on the 23rd, and I stayed until that, which was a Tuesday, and I stayed through Thanksgiving until that Saturday evening, which I believe was the 26th.
So can you give us a synopsis of what you saw over those several days when you were in North Dakota?
Absolutely. Because of the nature of the trip, I really did not know what to expect. And I think that that was true for a lot of people, especially like my travel partners who were going with me. We really didn't know what to expect. We were keeping up with what was going on social media and just trying to be as prepared as possible. But that was a little difficult just because things could change from day to day. So reports of what protectors had experienced the night before could have changed. And so we were just really, I think, trying to put ourselves in a space where we would be prepared for whatever. And overall, just getting there in and of itself was a big act of accomplishment for us. Once we got there and we pulled up alongside the side of the camp to get to the entrance, I remember seeing all of the signs, and the signs were kind of what made it real for me. Like, these people, they've been camped out here, they've made signs, and just reading through those, it really made it real. It's like, this is where it's happening, this is where this movement is happening, and this resistance is happening, and I'm privileged to be able to be here and to be able to join in solidarity with my Indigenous relatives and also those who have come who are non-Native to support. Again, that whole not knowing what to expect once I was inside of the camp, you know, was kind of quickly settled after maybe a day or so there. However, again, anything could change at any moment. And so just always having that apprehension in the back of your mind that this could not be like this tomorrow or later tonight. And just, I was prepared to go with the flow whatever needed to be done, wherever I was needed, was kind of what my goal was, what my agenda was. And for me, it was even deeper than going to stand up against the injustice of this one isolated incident of this pipeline being put within 10 minutes of the reservation. It was also a way for me to be able to be in a space that was Indigenous-led and that was populated with so many tribal nations coming together in a way that hasn't been done since the 70s. And to be able to be in that space and be around a community and culture that I frankly did not have the privilege of growing up with and growing up around, it was even more of a type of a spiritual need for me. And so to be able to combine the need that the tribe had with almost a need that I also had to be immersed in that type of space, it served that for me. One thing that I want to share is that when we first arrived, everyone was asked to attend an orientation to get an idea of what the camp was like and what the goal and mission was. And the two main ideas that I walked away with that really stuck with me was, first of all, the camp was not a festival. It was not a party. It was not a reunion. It was not a celebratory type of atmosphere.
Very serious?
It was more, it's sacred. Mm. So it was a place where we were coming to be in prayer and ceremony, and to take away kind of the fun aspect that people might have, like kind of the novelty aspect. We're going to do something new. We're resisting. That kind of got put into check when we got there. And we were reminded, this is serious. This is not a joke. This is not a drill. Every single day that you're here, you're participating actively in resistance. And we need to remember that we have to stay in prayer. This needs to be a prayerful space. And I also just really, really appreciated that being said. And it helped to remind me to try to approach any of the activities that I was involved in that way, with that sense of sincere respect and honor.
You mentioned that idea of being with other Indigenous people. And I guess one thing I wonder is, does this issue maybe move across tribal lines in a way that is different than maybe past experiences that you've had?
Absolutely. There are a few articles out there that I've read that mentioned that this incident specifically united tribes in a way that they haven't been united in a long time, whether because of just past historical conflict within, you know, each nation. Again, going back to what I said before, is that many of us felt really convicted inherently. And I think that's tied to being who we are as Native people, is that when we see a group that's having an issue and having a problem and they need our help, we need to be there. And I think that was felt really, really strongly in the situation. And so it did bring together different tribes that formerly may not have been associated together or worked together in a really long time. And I think that that's an amazing form of healing for what our nations have been through here in America. And so I really found that to be one of the, I would say, the positive aspects of this very serious issue, is that on this hand, it brought us together and it caused us to have to stand together with one mission, one purpose, one intent, and on the same agenda. And I think that was extremely powerful.
You are someone who's been involved in other issues specifically related to mascots, schools using Native
Absolutely.
American mascots for sporting events, for their sports teams. Do you see a connection between these two issues? And I guess if so, what would that connection be?
Absolutely. I need to share that as Indigenous people, based on the history of America and how it was founded and where the land came from, and even more specifically in this issue with DAPL, the Dakota Access Pipeline, the fact that it is on unceded Sioux land is really important, because it kind of it brings to light this conflict over what's whose and who has the rights to what. And I think it's really important to always remember, first and foremost, that we owe a lot of what we have to the people that were here before and set it up for us. So with that being said, at the same time, historically, there were many things set into place that prevented Native and Indigenous people from having access to equal rights. And even now, we're still struggling for those, and Native mascots are one key way that we are not on the table with other, even minority status races, as far as our race, culture, and spirituality being used as a mascot and as a show, accompanied with all kinds of antics that are very, very disrespectful and taken out of context of what they mean to us for sporting and athletic events. So the reason that they're tied hand in hand is because just like this pipeline is being put in the ground next to a reservation and basically letting these people know that this water is we want to protect it for ourselves, but, you know, we're really not as concerned if it's protected for you. You'll figure it out. You'll deal with it. And then the same thing transferring over to mascots. This is something that we want for ourselves. We want to take on this persona and this pseudo identity. And, you know, even though, yeah, it originally came from you, you kind of just need to deal with what we want to do with it. And you'll figure it out.
Okay, I don't want to go too far off the track here, but just so we have it on the record here in terms of how you view this, are you someone who thinks that there are degrees here? For instance, the football team in Washington, that nickname a lot of people object to. But there are, for instance, tribes which have worked with schools and have said, well, if you do this, this, and this, you can keep the nickname and you can do this at halftime, and we're okay with it. Where do you come down on that?
I basically go back to the saying that, you know, one person doesn't speak for all and all don't speak for one. Keep in mind that we're reclaiming and relearning our own identity as Native people. And so for a lot of the past generation, they were raised in a time where they did not have power and control over their identity. They didn't have power and control over how they were seen. They didn't have power of control towards not being discriminated against. This is just what they had to deal with. So in some way, shape, and fashion, I understand that for some people, it may be more important to be recognized in the mainstream than to not be there at all, which is what they realistically experienced. But however, I personally don't feel that allowing mascots in non-Native-led spaces is responsible. And keeping in mind who ultimately pays the price, our children pay the price. And it's our job to protect our children from discrimination. And it's our job to protect all non-Native children from both witnessing, participating in, and learning how to discriminate against other groups. So I feel that responsibility is something that we can't ignore. And as much as it may make us feel better to be acknowledged in some way, shape, or form, I don't think that's it.
So the victory, such as it is at Standing Rock, may be temporary. There's going to be a new administration coming in. This can get reviewed again. Do you view this as something that you would be willing to go back and protest again to stand up for what you believe on this?
Absolutely. The very difficult thing is watching members of this tribe and their supporters basically be brutalized by the police. I think that was the hardest thing to witness and to watch. And if that type of violence is something that's going to continue and it's going to keep, you know, mounting and growing, I absolutely feel that we need to, again, step up our direct action and our physical presence there. Of course, we all hope for the best, but given our history with the United States and with broken promises, we have to stay on edge and we have to stay alert and looking out. Would I personally go back? I would. It would be difficult, you know, given our everyday life, but then remembering that this is a strong need and this is something that that is very meaningful to fight for. A lot of people like myself, we just have to make it work.
Did you meet a lot of people in that same sort of place when you were at Standing Rock that said, yeah, this was something that was an inconvenience? I mean, you know, Thanksgiving, I'm sure a lot of people would have liked to have been home. And there were other people probably missing work, et cetera. So is there a lot of sort of, you know, having to put life on hold in a way or make other arrangements to take part in something like this?
Well, I was watching a video from the Young Turks yesterday, and it's funny that you said that. When we received the news of the Army Corps denying the easement, the person who was the announcer for the Young Turks said that he knew of people personally who had actually sacrificed long-term relationships to go out and be there, people who quit jobs and went out to be there. For some of us, that's not a possibility. Like for me, I have a family, so I have to stay employed and able to bring an income for them. But one of our announcers at the drum at Sacred Fire Circle, which is where we would gather every evening, listen to singing, drumming, have dancing, just a time to rejuvenate spiritually and really express our resistance in a prayerful way. He said, contrary to popular belief, I am not a paid protester. And if I'm wrong, then I need the Morton County Sheriff Department to send me my check because it's late. So none of us, we're giving of what we have. And I think that's one of the things that's really, really beautiful, both about the culture and about human kindness. And when humans feel that need to be there for one another, they figure it out. It may not be convenient. It may not be at the right time. It may not even financially be something that we know how we're going to figure out. But in my case, our crew that went, we were overly blessed by a village in Kalamazoo that put together funds for us. We got there and back and were taken care of that way so that we could focus on getting there and being there in presence. As for Thanksgiving, for me personally, I don't have a fond feeling towards Thanksgiving when it comes to Indigenous people in America. So I was okay not going along with the mainstream holiday celebration. And a lot of us, we were actually fed really well by the Standing Rock Community School there, and they took care of us. So, you know, it was a different type of celebration and a different type of ceremony on that day. It was actually being there and resisting the police brutality and the aggravating words that they were yelling down at us. And on that day, it was definitely, for me, it was a day of purpose on behalf of the injustices that Thanksgiving reminds a lot of Native people of.
I'm wondering if you think that there is also a larger issue here environmentally. I mean, because obviously there were great concerns about what this meant for drinking water. And then you come back to Michigan, where we're still looking at Flint and wondering when people there will be able to use something other than bottled water to cook and to drink. So, I mean, does this also play into a larger public health and environmental issue as well?
Absolutely. I don't know if you've heard the term environmental racism.
Not sure.
And I would also put classism into there. Basically, making resources more inaccessible in places where those who are more wealthy can afford to lose portions of the population due to that. And I think that that's really serious when it comes to doing that specifically and targeting certain ethnic groups. That is a form of genocide. And I think that's one reason why we are standing up so strongly to the Dakota Access Pipeline is because we're sick of experiencing genocide in so many shape-shifted forms. And when it comes to Flint, another reason that I felt very strongly about going to Standing Rock was because I got it. I was able to see, even though I personally don't live in Flint, I know in Kalamazoo we had an oil spill. And that to me was very, very close to home. It might be better now, but am I still looking at our drinking water as with a feeling of trust, as something that I can feel great, you know, putting all over my body or letting my kids drink? No, it's honestly not. And when I look at Flint, which is just 2.5 hours away from home, I feel very indignant that these people were considered dispensable enough to not have to stand up and do the right thing for people that the governor and his employees were responsible for making sure we're taken care of. And that to me just shows how racism is able to take the form of basically having an environmental aspect, you know, to that. And in Standing Rock, absolutely, I believe that's what's taking place. As I was reading today, that North Dakota is 90% Caucasian or Euro-American. And so if the pipeline wasn't good enough for those in Bismarck, it's not good enough for anybody.
Monica Padula, Washington, thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
You can find links with more coverage of the protests at Standing Rock and the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers' decision to deny a permit for a key section of the Dakota Access Pipeline at WMUK.org. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.